And Mr. Marshall, go ahead and call the final case.
Calling A240776, Minnesota Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company versus Bradshaw and Bryant Law Office PLLC.
All right, and counsel, both counsel, I think you know the procedures here. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes for your opening argument. Counsel for respondent, you'll have 15 minutes for your response argument. Then counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. The podium does adjust. It's right sort of in the center, but below the podium. So feel free to get settled in, adjust the podium, and when you're ready, please make sure you say your name and who you represent, because this an audio recording will be available later, and this is also being live streamed. So with that, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Pat O'Neill on behalf of appellant Bradshaw and Bryant. Today I'm going to be referring to my client as Bryant and respondent as MLM. This case requires interpretation of the Declaratory Judgment Act and the professional liability insurance policy issued to Bryant by MLM. MLM commenced this declaratory judgment action seeking to avoid its defense and indemnity obligations for a legal malpractice claim asserted against Bryant and its individual attorneys arising out of the firm's representation of Raymond Kovalvog in a wrongful death action. Bryant reported the Kovalvog claim to MLM in October of 2022 after receiving a demand letter from Ken White. MLM reserved its rights and later commenced this action against the Bryant firm only, seeking two separate forms of relief. One, a declaration that a claim was deemed made in 2019 and therefore Bryant's 2022 reporting of the claim was untimely. And two, a declaration that the claim represented a single occurrence subject to a $2 million limit. After limited discovery, MLM moved for summary judgment. The district court determined that a justiciable controversy existed between MLM and Bryant, the deemed made clause was unambiguous, and that a claim was deemed made in 2019, and that MLM was not required to establish any actual prejudice due to a delay in reporting. Reversal is required for four independent reasons. The suit did not present a justiciable controversy because MLM failed to join all necessary parties as required by the Declaratory Judgment Act. Two, the policy's deemed made clause is ambiguous as a matter of law. Three, fact questions regarding Bryant's subjective knowledge of a claim in October of 2019 precluded summary judgment. And four, Minnesota law required MLM to establish that it suffered actual prejudice by any delay in reporting. The first issue I'd like to address is justiciability. A declaratory judgment action must present a justiciable controversy or a district court has no jurisdiction to declare rights under the act. Minnesota's Declaratory Judgment Act is unique and requires joinder of, quote, all parties who have or claim any interest which would be affected by the declaration, and no declaration shall prejudice the rights of persons not party to the proceeding. That's Minnesota Statute 555.11. This requirement is broader than Rule 19 and broader than the Federal Declaratory Judgment Act because it applies to parties who, quote, claim any interest that may be affected by the outcome of the lawsuit.
Wouldn't every lawyer in the state be affected by the outcome of this lawsuit?
Maybe every MLM policyholder, right. But I think that we know from the Cincinnati versus Frank case that specifically in a liability insurance context, there's a triangle that we need to address. There's the policyholder, there's the insured, or there's the policyholder, there's the injured party, and there's the insurance company. And all three of those dots need to be connected to present a justiciable controversy because the district court has to balance the rights of all three of those parties by having...
That was not a coverage case, right?
Pardon?
The Frank case was not a coverage decision, was it?
I believe it was, Your Honor. The Frank case was...
Well, let me ask this. Are there not many cases in which coverage disputes are between the insured and the insurance company without the injured party?
There are certain cases, but the key here is that whether the failure to add a party affects justiciability depends on the nature of the rights sought to be declared. The nature of the rights sought to be declared here is I don't have to, MLM doesn't have to defend its insured or indemnify it, and there's a per occurrence limit limited at $2 million.
So it's only the second one, it seems to me, that would arguably go to the plaintiff, the Caval Bog.
Yeah, right? I would say that the claimant has an interest in both. A claimant has an interest in, you know, the outcome of whether or not there are indemnity dollars at stake.
So wouldn't that be true in every coverage case? If only issue one was there, is there coverage for this?
Yes.
Does the injured party always have to be unlike many coverage cases where the plaintiff injured party is not there?
I would say the answer to that question is yes, and that's well established from the Frank case, which says we have to balance the rights of the injured party, the insured tortfeasor, and the insurance company.
So has it been a mistake in all of those other cases where the injured party is not a party to the deck action on coverage for the courts to have considered it?
It depends on the nature of the relief sought.
Just coverage, that there's defense and indemnification coverage.
I would say potentially, Your Honor, yes. Or since the Frank case was decided in 2001.
Can we get to... I don't know how much more you have on issue one. I don't want to raise it. I do want to get to issue two next, I think.
Yes, Your Honor. I just want to also touch on the fact that the specific facts of this case where MLM was aware of the claimed interest of the Caval Vogs, they were in direct communication with them. The Caval Vogs raised a specific coverage issue about the available limit, and they chose not to include them in this lawsuit while seeking relief to address an issue raised not by Brian, but by Caval Vog. So a specific choice to exclude the injured party, the claimant, from the declaratory judgment action that would affect a right that they were aware of, I think should count for something in this case that may not be present in all the other cases that you're talking about, Judge Smith. I'd also like to touch on waiver. Justiciability is an issue that can never be waived. It was not raised at the district court. That is true. However, it's an issue that can never be raised and is often raised by this court on its own initiative. You can look at the Stroner case, which is unpublished and cited in our brief. Is it raised by the court on its own initiative? And in the Frank case, the one that I believe controls this dispute, it was raised by the court on its own initiative as well. Turning to issue two, which is whether or not the policy is ambiguous. We're focusing on the deemed made clause here, which MLM is attempting to use to limit coverage by working backwards from a timely reported claim in October 2022 to identify some earlier event that they can use to deny coverage. The deemed made clause is being used as an exclusion here and should therefore be construed against MLM. The provision states that a claim is deemed made when one of two separate events occur. A demand is communicated to the insured for damages, or an insured first becomes aware of any actual or alleged act that could support or lead to a claim. Here, both triggering events occurred at different times. In October 2022, Bryant received a demand letter from Ken White. In October of 2019, MLM claims that Bryant received notice of claim from Lori Johnson. The district court did not evaluate the effect of the October 2022 report and instead focused solely on the October 2019 communications and case law discussing the importance of notice in a claims made policy, rather than the specific language of the deemed made clause.
What about the specific language in subpart two, first becomes aware? Why doesn't that obviate the ambiguity that you're identifying?
The first becomes aware language is confined to clause two. It's not. It doesn't appear above that. It doesn't modify the deemed made clause as a whole, and is kind of cabined in that second exception. That argument was not raised to the district court. The district court didn't couch its analysis on that argument, and I think that brings us to
a de novo review on an interpretation question. Right?
Yes, Your Honor. But I think that brings us to a potential third reasonable interpretation of the deemed made clause. The first reasonable interpretation may be Judge Conley's. The second reasonable interpretation was reached by another Hennepin County District Court judge less than 60 days prior to Judge Conley's decision. In the Smith-Jaden case, which is pending before this court, Judge Janisch reached a completely different conclusion based on the same insurance policy and the same insurance clause.
So let me understand your reasonable interpretation. So your interpretation, I want to have different examples. If the 2019 letter, litigation hold letter, and follow-up email, assume for purposes of argument, and I think you have some challenges to that, but assume for purposes of argument that that satisfies paragraph 2 of the deemed made, that the party first became aware of an alleged act that could support a claim. Okay, if it satisfies paragraph 2, another litigation hold letter identical to that in 2022 couldn't be considered, right, as reported during the policy period. In other words, you don't get to, because it's first aware, right? You can't be first aware more than once. Is that accurate? I mean, under your interpretation.
Under my interpretation, the policy is silent as to what happens when both events occur.
No, I know. I'm saying, let's say event two occurs more than once. It can't, right? You can only be first aware one time.
Agreed.
Right? Okay. And then paragraph one is a demand for damages, right?
Right.
Say that you got a demand for damages in 2019 that was not reported. Can a demand for damages in 2022 be made, and then it falls within the policy period? Can you have multiple claims by multiple demand for damages over time?
No, it has to be either one or the other. So what happens when both?
So you can't have two under, you can't have multiple under two, you can't have multiple under one.
Right, but what happens?
Your argument is just that if you have two first, you become aware, and a demand later, that they both, that the demand counts, right? Under
that,
paragraph one.
That the policy can't be read in a way that you are obligated to go to the earliest occurrence of those two events. That there's no temporal language in the clause that requires a court to say, no, as soon as we're defaulting to the earliest occurrence of the two events. There's, the policy is silent to that. Many other policies are not.
So you could then, so that the law firm could say, okay, send me a demand letter down the road. And then we'll trigger coverage. So it, as long as a demand letter happens down the road, it will trigger coverage. So the same claim can be deemed made twice, right? It can be deemed made in 2019 and deemed made in 2022. That's your argument, as I understand it, right?
It can be deemed made upon the receipt of a demand for damages, but just because it could have been deemed made earlier based on some amalgamation of certain facts or events doesn't mean that you have to default to the earlier of the two occurrences.
And why couldn't you do multiple under one? I'm just wondering why, if you can have multiple, if the same claim can occur multiple times under your theory, either under one or under two, or well, I guess under two and then under one. I'm just wondering what the logical limits are. Why couldn't it be deemed made multiple times under paragraph one?
Demand for damages is distinct from the second knowledge of acts or awareness. And here a demand for damages was made on October 7th, 2022. It was a $5 million demand. It's in Exhibit 14 to the Goodman Declaration.
Oh, what was the demand in 2022? I thought it was the Ken White letter.
Ken White sent more than one letter. And those letters are referenced in a communication to Bryant by Alice Sharon. It's Exhibit 14 to the Goodman Declaration, and it references a specific demand letter.
Okay, so I guess I may have misunderstood from briefing. I thought that the demand that we were talking about was the October 14th letter that says
they're both in October of 2022.
Oh, okay, where there was an act. Because I was wondering, that was going to be a question, what makes the October 2014, I'm retained to represent Caval Bog in relation to malpractice, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't make a demand for money in that.
There's a subsequent communication referenced by MLM to Bryant that says October 7th, 2022, we're aware of a demand. And it may exceed $5 million. That's what it says.
Okay.
And so that is the demand for damages that's distinct from issue number two.
Okay.
What do we do with the language that follows one and two? There's language in the policy that says all claims arising out of the same or related professional services shall be considered one claim and shall be deemed made when the first claim was deemed made. It seems to me that that is the limiting language that says you go with either one or two. Like whichever is first, that's one claim and that's it.
I don't agree with that, Your Honor, and neither did Judge Giannis. I think that the fact of the matter is it doesn't say that we are obligated to take the earliest occurring event in time. It says that there are two separate things that may trigger a claim being deemed made. One's a demand, the other is knowledge of specific facts. It does not say the earlier of the two events must be the one under which it's deemed made.
Well, but so the 2019, would you say that's a claim that was deemed made under two?
The 2019 notice may have been sufficient to put him on. There is no evidence that the 2019 communications put Mike Bryan on subjective notice that there was a claim against his law firm.
Well, the back notice to the matter. Says potential malpractice actions against you. Please notify your malpractice carrier.
Right,
I don't
and
know
this
how
gets
much
us to
more
issue,
specific you can be.
This gets us to issue number three, Your Honor, which is the district court improperly weighed facts and made credibility determinations. I see that my time is up, but I'd like to finish answering your question.
Please.
There were no depositions taken in this case. Mike Bryan submitted a sworn statement in connection with the summary judgment hearing. In that affidavit, he said that I was confused by the litigation hold notice I received from Lori Johnson because we previously transferred all our files to her law firm. And I sent an email saying, what is this about? She responded to that email, but he never read, acted, or understood that email. His unequivocal testimony is that
he doesn't remember reading it.
He wasn't aware of it. He had no knowledge of it, and he didn't act on it. He claims that the first time that he became aware of it was when he was collecting documents to produce in this litigation. So he's denied specifically receiving that. The district.
I don't think he denied receiving it. He found it in his own stuff.
The email was in his inbox. That's true, Your Honor, but he did not read it. That's his testimony.
He doesn't remember reading it.
I believe he said that he did not read. He does not recall. He did not open, read, or act on the email from Lori Johnson following up to the litigation hold notice. I believe that's what his testimony was on that issue. And for the district court to just...
I have no specific memory of opening, reading, or acting on that email.
Right.
I have no specific memory of that. Okay. I'm just wondering how you prove that later, that, I mean, he doesn't remember it. Maybe he did. I'm not sure what's missing there for a genuine factual dispute.
I think that that's a credibility determination that the jury is allowed to make. Mike Bryant can testify in this matter and say, I don't recall reading that email. I don't recall opening it. Had I opened it, I would have done something with it, which is exactly what he did in October of 2022. When he received a communication, he sent it to reference legal malpractice. He sent it on to his carrier. There was no effort here to avoid or ignore any communication that referenced legal malpractice. The fact is that when he got one, he sent it on. I think that that's strong evidence that he never received the communication from Lori Johnson. With that, I will save the rest of my remarks for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, when you're ready, feel free to adjust the podium and you'll have 15 minutes for your argument.
Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Chris Goodman. I represent the respondent, Minnesota Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company. We're asking the court to affirm the district court's decision in the case. I understand it's de novo review, but the analysis that the district court applied tracks the case law that the appellate courts in the state have issued, instructing the district courts how to interpret and apply insurance policy language. I'll go through the four issues that counsel identified in his comments. Obviously, the court will redirect me as it sees fit. On justiciability, though, aside from my prepared comments, there was some back and forth about whether the aggregate limit is $5 million. That was an issue that was raised in the deck action. That was an issue that the district court reached, but that's not an issue that's raised to this court in the appellate brief. I double-checked that. So to the extent we're having a back and forth about what the available limit is under this policy, the per occurrence or the aggregate limit. That's not something that's been briefed to this court, so I don't think that's something that's before the court. On justiciability, number one, there is no case cited in the appellant's brief in which an appellate court in this state has set aside a declaratory judgment in an action between insurer and policyholder because the injured party wasn't joined. There's no case that says that that was addressed by the district court or certainly cited to this court in the briefs for today. Number two, to the extent counsel wants to direct the panel's attention to the Cincinnati Insurance v. Frank case, we hit that on page 16 of our brief. The flaw in the deck action in that case was the insurer, Cincinnati, did not include the policyholder, its own policyholder, in the action. So the case law from this state, I believe Unbank, the other case the appellant cite, says the same thing. If an insurance company is going to seek a declaration of its rights and obligations under a policy, you better include your policyholder.
Was it MLM only the absence of the policyholder in Cincinnati Insurance v. Frank? Wasn't it also the injured party?
That's not how I read the decision, but I mean, we even quote, since quoting from page 274 of the Cincinnati decision, I probably shouldn't be speaking away from the microphone, Cincinnati's failure to include its own policyholder defeats the requirement that a controversy involve a concrete assertion of legal rights between adverse parties. So that's what Cincinnati says. Also, the cases that we cite in our brief that do address the issue and instruct all of us on how to look at these issues are not addressed at all in the appellant's reply brief. I'll begin with State Auto v. Lee, Minnesota Supreme Court case, 1977. If there is an interested party under Rule 19 and it is not joined, that does not render void the declaratory judgment the district court reaches between the parties to the case.
But it is not a just. We did vacate in Cincinnati v. Frank. We did vacate that, right? I mean, that's a later case. I understand. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if you think maybe that was wrongly decided given. I'm wondering how you square that.
What I'm saying is there is no case in Minnesota that says to an insurance company or to the insured, if either party under the policy is commencing a deck action to resolve a coverage dispute, the injured plaintiff has to be joined. If I can give a little more clarity to this, one of the cases we cite is the Lower Sioux Tribal Community versus Krause-Anderson case, which also cites to a federal rules decision from the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, Courageous Insurance, I'm saying that right, versus Wheeler. What those two cases say, I have them in front of me, is under Rule 19, an interested party has a legally protected interest in the outcome of the dispute, not a mere financial interest. The reason why those two cases were cited in a way that supports the district court's decision in this case is the Courageous case being an example. The plaintiff in a malpractice action had perhaps an expectancy that if they established liability against the tortfeasor, the insured, they would then have a right, if the insured couldn't pay, to try and get money from the insurance policy. But they didn't hold a legally protected interest.
What about the other lawyers who are insured parties? That they are indispensable parties in the deck action.
Yeah, a number of problems with that. First and foremost, the named insured under the policy is the firm, its members and employees, which is to say if a plaintiff were to start a lawsuit against the Bradshaw and Bryant firm but not name the individual lawyer that allegedly committed the malpractice, it wouldn't work very well if MLM were to say, well, we're defending the firm but not Mr. Bryant because he wasn't named. It doesn't work that way. So using the same analysis, if the named insured under the policy is the firm, its members and employees, then if we seek a declaration of the firm, the named insured's rights under the policy, that encompasses its members and employees. We also have the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Rhode Island case that we cite, which is also not addressed in the appellant's reply. That case says that if you are aware of a deck action and you believe you have rights that are being addressed in that proceeding, and you choose to sit on the sideline until the court renders a decision, you can't come along after that decision is reached and say, hey, what about me? I have an interest in this. And that's exactly what we're having here. neither in the answer that was filed in the district court proceeding or the briefing of the motion that resolved the case did the insured, the appellant, say that the individual Bryant attorneys had any rights under the policy. It only comes up for the first time on appeal, which is our waiver argument. But they don't have any different rights than the firm does. They're all under the umbrella of the named insured under the policy. And so if there's a declaratory judgment rendered with respect to the insurer versus the insured, that encompasses the people, the individuals that the appellant in this case is complaining about. Well, what about Mr. Crumley? What about a particular associate? They're all named insureds under the policy.
But isn't that the reason why they say they should be involved, because they are affected by it? That the decision will affect them?
So when I talk about the named insured, that addresses Your Honor's question as to why the proper parties were named in the deck action to afford complete relief, the firm. The firm is a named insured, and under the policy, it includes its members. To the second question, which is, well, what about the interest they're now claiming for the first time on appeal? The Blue Cross Blue Shield of Rhode Island case addresses that and says, no. If you are aware of this declaratory proceeding and you claim you have an interest, you can't come along after that issue has been decided and then say, what about me? Think of it like an estoppel situation.
Oh, no, I understand that part. I was really at the first part, I guess. Why, if they are affected by it, why aren't they necessary to start with?
Yes, we cite Minnesota statute from Chapter 323A, from Chapter 540, that talk about notice to a partner is notice to the partnership. A judgment against a partner is a judgment against the partnership. Even if you resort to common law or statutes, the analysis is the same. If the firm is named in the deck action, that encompasses its members and employees. That's also, again, what the policy says when it defines the named insured. And the other point I've been making is, to the extent there's some claim that they weren't aware of the proceeding, well, Mr. Bryant verifies the answers to interrogatories, submits a declaration in the case, and attends the dispositive motion hearing. The firm had full notice of this proceeding. So if anyone wanted to raise their hand and say, well, I have a different interest, they should be heard. The other point I may just make on a practical level, what argument would be raised by an individual Bryant attorney beyond the arguments that were raised by its counsel on behalf of the firm? It's the same issue. Was there notice? When was the claim made and reported?
So if we move from the justiciability, unless my colleagues have more questions on that, and I do see, I was confused about the triangular part of Cincinnati. It's the primary insurance is the other person, not the injured party. So, right, there's like three that you didn't, they didn't have the insured, they didn't have the primary.
I believe that's the passage I read. Yeah, sorry.
Yep, you're right. Okay, the policy. What is wrong, what is unreasonable about the argument that a claim can be deemed made under your policy, it's at best ambiguous or it's just missing language, that a claim can be deemed made when they first become aware in 2019 and can be deemed made also when there's a demand letter. And in the absence of language saying a policy cannot be deemed made twice and that it can only be, that the first one is controlling, why is that an unreasonable argument?
So that's the Judge Yannis' decision in the Smith-Jaden Johnson case. And what the district court in this case, and in our brief conclude or argue, is the appellate courts instruct how insurance policies like contracts are supposed to be interpreted. We have to give meaning to all the words. The critical problem with that analysis is if the demand under one triggers the deemed made clause, then it eliminates the relevance of two, which is first becoming aware. I think a thought experiment illustrates this. Let's say, as happened here, there's a notice of claim letter that unmistakably says, put your malpractice carrier on notice in 2019. But let's omit from our fact pattern the 2022 demand letter, which would satisfy one, right? And then Mr. White, instead of making a demand, as often happens in a tort suit, he just commences the lawsuit. Okay, if that happens, the entire deemed made clause, which gives MLM an opportunity to have pre-suit notification of the claim, an ability to advise its insured how to proceed, and perhaps even an opportunity to settle the claim before it proceeds to litigation, all of that is out the window. That is why it is not ambiguity. The two competing interpretations have to be reasonable. We cite the Ross case.
Why do you have paragraph one in the policy? Because if a demand is communicated, that person will become aware. Why is that necessary? Why don't you just have paragraph 2 under your reading?
Well, because it's possible, as also happens in my practice, where the first notice you get of a claim isn't a notice of claim letter, I'm investigating, please hold evidence relevant to the claim, but a demand.
Right.
This is
and
making
a demand would satisfy too, wouldn't it? You become aware of an act which could support a claim. Oh, I just became aware I got a demand letter.
Yes.
I can't really figure out how one helps. One wouldn't always be part of two, even under your own reading of it.
Well, to that I would say that appellate courts often reach conclusions, that if only the insurance policy had said something else, right, this wouldn't have occurred. By including one and two, MLM is saying to its insured, if you get a notice of claim or a demand before suit, the claim is deemed made and you should report it. The other problem with the Smith-Jaden decision is it doesn't address the disjunctive word or. The jurists, the advocates in this room, we all know what or means. It means either of the conditions or circumstances stated in the statute, or in this case an insurance policy, satisfy the condition. So when this policy is written with the simple word or between one and two, it's saying if either of these things occur, the claim is deemed made and your obligation to report it is triggered. That's further demonstrated by the language Your Honor was quoting from defining how the per occurrence versus aggregate limit was applied. The first claim deemed made is one claim for purposes of applying the coverage limits. Additionally, the district court in the Smith-Jaden case says, well, if only there was a temporal language. Well, the canons of contract interpretation say that courts aren't supposed to read into ambiguities into the policy. And in this case, MLM is being faulted for not writing the policy a different way. And as I mentioned a moment ago, the use of the word or satisfies the issue. Either condition is sufficient. But, and I believe Judge Schmidt hit this, in two it says, maybe Frisch, first becomes aware of any actual or alleged act, error, or omission. So the policy is saying, if you get an email and a letter, and there's some correspondence that you get putting you on notice of a claim, not a demand, because that would be one. The first time you are put on notice of an act or omission that could lead to a claim, that's when you need to report it, giving MLM the opportunity, prior to a lawsuit being commenced, to decide whether to intervene, advocate for its client. Another way to look at it...
Well, go ahead, Your Honor. Don't need... It may not be the case here, but I'm trying to understand what you think your contract says. So under paragraph 2, it's a notice of a claim. It doesn't include, the reason I ask that is a claim includes just merely, the first three parts of a claim means someone told you that they have a claim. And then paragraph 4 and under the definition says an act by a person.
Yes, so
and
in
then
our,
2
I'm sorry.
Says you become aware of it, and part of the argument is, all right, I know as a lawyer I did something. I represented them. I decided on this jury instruction, et cetera. Why, you're saying that wouldn't, just knowledge of what you did wouldn't constitute paragraph 2?
No, that's the argument that, I think it's a straw man argument that the appellant raises. The appellant says, well, just because there's a bad act doesn't mean we have a duty to report. That's an unreasonable interpretation of the policy. Mm-hmm. The district court addresses that. There was certainly evidence in the record that a problem was coming, bad outcome in the case, substitution of counsel, file transferred, and a motion filed for new trial criticizing Bryant's representation. But that's not why the district court said, standing alone, the duty to report the claim was triggered. And that's why the judge says repeatedly in the decision in this case, at the latest, the claim was deemed made by October 2019, because that's when, on the heels of the facts, the bad outcome facts I'm talking about, that we get the litigation hold and notice of claim letter and email from the other firm.
Right. No, I understand that. I'm sorry to go over,
presiding judge.
In this case, I just wondered about what I thought you had said is the meaning of your contract, not the application of it in this case. But that's fine. I understand what you're saying.
Yes, we have bad acts and notice of claim in the soup, so to speak, in the record. And that's why the district court said at the latest, this avalanche of facts triggers that duty to report by October 2019. So with that, we'd ask the court to affirm the district court's decision in properly interpreting the policy and concluding the claim was deemed made in 2019 and that coverage was forfeited because it was, the claim was not reported until 2022. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes.
Thank you. I'd like to start with the justiciability issue. I think I'd like to refocus us. We're not talking about Rule 19 here or joinder. We're talking about the requirements of Minnesota Statute 555.11, which state that all persons who claim or have an interest in the outcome of the declaration shall be made parties to the lawsuit. The reason that that matters is because people who may claim obviously have a contingent interest. They don't need a judgment against the insured to be parties to the lawsuit. The fact that they may claim the interest means that they have to be parties. And that, again, is consistent with the outcome in Frank and also Stroner. Stroner versus City of Hopkins is an unpublished decision from this court where parties hired by an individual invoiced the City of Hopkins. The City of Hopkins then commenced suit against the individual that hired those people, seeking a declaration that it didn't have to pay their bills. This court, raising justiciability on its own for the first time on appeal, determined that not everybody who needed to be a party to that lawsuit was present, because the claimants who, even though they had a contingent interest against the city, they weren't hired by the city, but they were entitled to compensation under some sort of administrative act, had to be parties to that lawsuit as fee claimants. This is essentially the same situation we have here. Kovalvog has a legal malpractice claim against Bryant that will eventually be, or may eventually be, paid by MLM, and Kovalvog needs to know the available limits and the existence of coverage to effectively conduct its settlement negotiations. They have a clear interest. That interest was made known to MLM, and yet they were still not included in this lawsuit. I'd also like to, talk about the individual Bryant attorneys. The individual Bryant attorneys paid premiums the same way the firm paid premiums, because it's all one and the same, and they had a reasonable expectation to be covered under the policies.
Why doesn't the fact that they sued the entire law firm cover the individual attorneys?
Similarly to the analogy offered by Mr. Goodman, what if they would have just sued the individuals? Could MLM commence suit against the firm only and have its rights declared that way? I think that all parties to the underlying lawsuit that's at issue need to be made parties to the declaratory judgment lawsuit, if the declaratory judgment lawsuit is going to affect the availability of defense and indemnity coverage in that merits lawsuit.
If you have a firm like Jones Day, you got to name anybody and everybody in the firm?
You'd have to name the attorneys that were named in the complaint or that worked on the file, giving rise to the legal malpractice claim. We're not in a situation where this is...
You have to name the people who are in fact sued or everyone who worked on it in the deck action?
It would depend on the timing, but in fact sued would be a good way to do it, who worked on the file. We're not talking about a class action lawsuit here or a large number of people. Everybody was known. All the plaintiffs were known. All the possible defendants were known. It would not have been infeasible or impractical to include them. They all had either actual or claimed interest in the outcome of the lawsuit, yet we're here without them present.
And remind me, was the deck action brought after they were named individual defendants in the lawsuit?
I believe that I know that the legal malpractice lawsuit was filed after the declaratory judgment lawsuit. I'm not sure if it was served prior to or if it changed in the middle there.
Okay, so at the time the deck action was initiated, it was unknown what individuals might be sued.
It was known. I think that it would have been known from MLM's investigation of the Bradshaw and Bryant file, the proof of claim, all the communications between Ken.
Did the individual defendants know that they were being? I guess, were they sued yet? That's my question. I guess at the time of the deck action.
I don't believe so.
Okay. Because then, what MLM should have to do is figure out who might be sued by the injured party of those individuals, and then include them all, in your view? because they might in fact be sued?
As policyholders, yes. The same way in an additional insured situation where I a contractor is an additional insured under another contractor's insurance policy, if you were to commence suit against the first contractor only, that would prohibit you from, that would prohibit the individual insured from raising its own issues. I see that my time is up if there are no further questions.
I'm not seeing any, so thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments today and for the briefs that you submitted. We will get a decision out in the statutory time frame. And that being the end of our calendar today, we are adjourned.
All rise.